Last speaker for the afternoon is Ben Choi from Snell Hopkins, who's been a sort of pioneer really using modeling in conjunction with SPECT imaging of the heart. He's going to talk about where we are today.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the organizers who invited me to come to give you a talk about what we do. And I was asked to talk about SPECT and PET originally. I look at the program. I thought there was talk about heart modeling, so I thought I would take this opportunity to give you show you something about what we have been doing about heart modeling and how we use it in PET and SPECT in development. I'm a physicist, or so-called medical physicist. A little bit of a math background, but of course I'm not a so-called a pure math, I'm more an applied mathematic person. And I've been working in radiology and biomedical engineering, and our work is mostly in the image generation. In the physicists, we involve in instrumentation to try to understand the physics of imaging and try to put that understanding into generating better images. So from that, we can start also devise method to improve the image quality. So the goal is primarily, our goal is to understanding the physics and see what we can do and to improve instrumentation and reconstruction method and so on and so forth to improve image quality and ultimately improve clinical diagnosis. So today I'm going to give you some introduction, and I was asked to give you some fundamentals of nuclear medicine imaging. So start with 2D planar nuclear medicine, and we go to the three-dimensional emission computer tomography, include single photon emission tomography and positron emission tomography. And I'll tell you a little bit about the quantitative emission computer tomography imaging techniques, which is something that we have been working on this for many years. And because of that, spurred us to develop a computer-generated phantoms and also how we use them for our work. And also, at the end, I'll tell you a little bit about molecular emission computer tomography imaging technique that involves small animal SPECT and PET if I have time. And first of all, I want to introduce you to different categories of medical imaging technique. And first, you can divide them into kind of a function of time. The traditional, mostly, in the early days, mostly two-dimensional planar imaging, so nuclear medicine, the 2D nuclear medicine, one of the early medical imaging technique. And then the more modern technique is getting into three-dimensional and four-dimensional imaging now. So the positron emission tomography, the single photon emission computer tomography is kind of in that category. And then now, as you know, that the emerging imaging field now is all this field that molecular imaging and the nuclear medicine is inherently a molecular imaging technique because it you can tag the molecule. And then you can also divide medical imaging techniques into the different type of category. One is a technique that look at the anatomical structure of the human body, such like X-ray, ultrasound, and magnetic resonance imaging. And also, you can categorize other techniques, look at the functional, not just anatomical information. The nuclear medicine is including positive PET and SPECT. It's pretty much part of the functional imaging technique. And also magnetic resonance imaging, and now the CT, the fast CT, multi-detector CT also, because it's fast enough, can allow us to start looking at diffusion type of thing now. And also the multimodality is the kind of a catchword now. Everybody talk about multimodality, and for instance, PET. And then PET, like PET CT just coming to mind about two or three years ago, really. But now there's nothing. No one is buying just PET. Everybody finding PET-CT, so the field is changing tremendously fast. So what is the fundamentals of nuclear medicine? The fundamental nuclear medicine is that you use some kind of radioactive material. That's the first thing you need to know. So therefore, you're involving the radionuclide production. You need to learn how to produce a radioactive material. After you get the isotope, you have to label it using radiochemistry to some molecule or agent to allow you to interrogate the body function. And then you need to study the pharmacological study, you need to study the biodistribution of the drug that carry the or the radioactivity get carried by the drug. And then you also, it's very important, you know the internal dosimetry. And then also the preclinical studies, so animal study we have to do before you try it on human, and then this instrumentation and imaging technique is a very big part of trying to get the nuclear medicine imaging going, clinical trial, and then clinical application. So in terms of radionuclide production, you can consider the two categories. One is the simple type of radionuclei that emit gamma photon. So most of the nuclear medicine in the clinical sense is using this type of simple radionuclei that emit a gamma, one or two or one or few, or gamma radiation. You just detect them one at a time. The other type, particularly being used in PET, is a radioisotope that emit positron. It's a strange type of thing. If you read science fiction, you know that somewhere in the universe there is anti-U, right? And you never want to meet them. If you meet them, it's just an electron meeting the positron, and then you meet them, and then you go boom, two of them, boom, disappear, and then become two photons. So make sure that you never find your anti-U. But anyway, so in the positron, in the PET, you basically use this particular isotope that emit positron. It turns out that the positron emitter are the kind of radio element that exists in your body. So as a result, positron has this nice property, allow you to trace the body and the metabolic function. So it's very nice, even though it's very difficult to do, some of them very short half-life, require in-house cyclotron to do, but because of the biology, it's getting a lot of excitement to do PET. It allows you to study a lot of the biological function. Once you have the radionuclei, you have to again label them to some kind of a drug. So I'm not a chemist, but this is bad for me. But somehow you kind of label the activity to some kind of a drug. In this case, it's a very complex annexin 5, for instance, to look at apoptotic cell. And then once you make the agent, then you have to study the biodistribution. Which organ does it go? How much you go? And then you know, kind of use that to decide what you can use it for. And then you have to use design instrumentation and imaging technique. In the standard gamma, two-dimensional planar imaging, basically you inject something. In this particular case, you inject in the organ, and the agents, they carry the radioactive material to this particular organ, and then if the organ, say, for instance, the liver, if it is healthy, that will uniformly distribute it, then if you have a position-sensitive detector device, that means that allow you to find out where does the photon comes in so that you can get an image of the gamma ray distribution or the radio pharmaceutical distribution, and from that you can come up with disease. Some of you, I guess, UCLA is no different from other universities. You have party time in Thursday, Friday, right? If you party too much, you know what happened, it's not good for your liver. And if your liver get into cirrhosis, have too much to drink, then you might have a cirrhosis, the part of the liver doesn't work, then won't take up, say, the sulfur colloid in the agent that we use in liver scanning. Then you leave a hole, then you can see the hole, that means that you probably should stop drinking and start studying, hit the books. And then these are some of the sample imaging for two-dimensional. You can use this, depending on what you use, you can study all kind of stuff. This is called the functional. It's not anatomical. You can use it to study bone, you can use it to study cancer, you can study to the apoptotic cells. So nuclear medicine is very powerful in the sense that it studies the function, not the anatomical. You see that it's a very ugly image. You don't see a lot of detail, but it shows you the particular function that the radionuclei allow you to look at instead of the anatomical structure. Now, what is emission computed tomography? Emission computed tomography is a very important functional imaging. The main component you can think about emission computed tomography is two components. One is the conventional two-dimensional nuclear medicine imaging technique that we talked about. The second one is so-called, the second component that makes up computed tomography is this mathematic. Call Institute of Pure Applied Mathematics, you should know that. You probably study that in your probably required courses. And this is the whole mathematics that involve image reconstruction from projections. Okay, and this is so combining the standard imaging technique with the mathematics. So combining a 2D imaging technique with the two-dimensional, three-dimensional reconstruction allow you to get the three-dimensional information. Now, so this is called the three-dimensional emission computer tomography. Again, it's two category. It's the single photon emission tomography using the readily available pharmaceutical, and then the positron tomography using this kind of positron. Okay, and there's a major difference. And because of the difference, and you're not actually looking at the positron, you're looking at the annihilation of positron with electron that comes out with a pair of 511 keV, and that's the detecting of this coincident photon that involving a very complex detector and instrumentation. And that's what you hear in the newspapers, a lot of this the exciting, you know, sexy, you know, pet equipment, expensive, and so on and so forth. And so just to mention to you, now you're all mathematician here, so I'm not going to show you any math because I would be embarrassed to talk about math in front of you guys. So I'm going to show you a very simple concept of image reconstruction. You probably all know about this. Is that in two-dimensional projection images, if you have, say, two-dimensional image of a three-dimensional distribution, give me an example of a bone scan, and then you, for instance, if you see some hotspot here indicating that possibly there's some bone metastasis going on if you have cancer. So the question is, where is that metastasis? Is that in the sternum or is it in the spine? Now, in an image like this, you said, I don't know, okay? It can be in the spine or it can be in the sternum. So the conventionally, how you do that is that you do a so-called oblique view. Suppose you kind of put it on the other way a little bit, then you can separate them. You can see, oh, this lesion is probably involving the spine, and this one maybe is in the sternum. Okay, so allow you to kind of look at that. Okay, so this is called like a multiple, in a different view. You allow you to get a two-dimensional type of information, and so some of you know that it's called a depth of field, right? I mean, you can do experiment. You know why you have two eyes? Why don't you have one eye? Why do you have an extra eye? Besides being a spare, okay, in case, okay, is that allow you to have the depth of information. You can do a very simple experiment. You close one eye, you have two finger, and you try to touch the fingertips. You cannot do that. Try that, go home and try that with one eye. But with two eyes, you can touch your fingertips. That's tell you that depth of a field. They give you a little bit of a two-dimensional, but you know two eyes sometimes is still not good enough. So the idea is that if you have many eyes, that you can go around the object, okay, and see it from many, many angles. Then you say, well, perhaps you can take all the projection, and then you can reconstruct something inside. Okay, so mathematical term in pure mathematics and applied mathematics, this is called the inverse problem. Now you know that. You probably subscribe a journal called Inverse Problem. There's a whole journal. Right now, if you look at an Inverse Problem journal, you will see many, many papers on reconstruction, because this is the most exciting inverse problem, okay? And the last of time, inverse, four by four matrix, try to inverse it. You know, the professor say, that's easy, try to do a 10 by 10. He said, you're crazy, okay? Now, in image reconstruction, we try to do nuclear medicine 64 by 64. Your math professor say you're crazy to inverse it. In CT, we talk about inversing a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix. You tell me how to do that, okay? So this is a very difficult problem, and that's what we are still kind of working on that. But you're too late now. So that problem has been solved. and that actually was a Nobel Prize, and you would have a chance. But you don't have a chance now. This is being taken by Comet in Boston. And so that's a problem that was solved by mathematician and won the Nobel Prize, shared Nobel Prize in medicine. So 1975 was Nobel Prize shared by a physicist and a mathematician. Actually, Comet is also a physicist, so it kind of turned into a mathematician. So that's the problem that he actually solved, and is why is it so hard? And actually, the problem was solved by a lot of astronomer, the Leon's friend, way back. But then they were not in medicine. There was no Bracewell. I already solved all this problem. But somehow, if you work in medicine, you have even something discovered before, you can still have a chance. And they went to Nobel Prize. Medicine kind of slow. But So the image reconstruction is to get this true activity. So you get the data, and then you try to apply so-called image reconstruction technique. The Nobel Prize, the first of all, before Nobel Prize, in nuclear medicine, a guy called Dave Kuh in the 60s already tried to say, we have many, many eyes, I get all the projections, I should be able to get reconstruction. But he didn't know the math. He built a machine. Unless you have hardware, you know software is useless. There's always hardware software debate. And he built a machine, but he don't know how to reconstruct. Okay, one of my friends, you may know Charlie Metz was a student at the time, working on a problem. He was given the problem to solve. He said he worked on it for about 3 or 4 months. He said it's almost there. He said, give him 2 more weeks, he will solve that problem. But somehow he got into another problem. He said he just missed the Nobel Prize. But anyway, so that's what asked him, okay, that's what he said. But anyway, so that time they used this called simple back projection method. Intuitive, not mathematical, get some reconstructed image, but it's worse than a 2D plane. It's no good. Okay, so nobody uses it now. So until the Nobel Prize kind of technique and article come out, so you can get the inverse radon transform a problem. So it's so-called the filter of the back projection or the back projection or filter projection method, they're kind of equivalent. So those are the kind of methods that have been around. So he said, that's a problem is solved. Not really, okay? So there's still a couple of more Nobel Prize. And I remember, some people said that in the 70s, what happened to the Nobel Prize, all the problem is solved. But today, if you go to inverse problem, if you go to statistical journals, okay, you will find there's still reconstruction problem being studied. The reason is that the problem is solved when you have ideal situation. The problem is not ideal. The problem, you have noise. The problem, you have all the physics involved in the data. So therefore, you can never get back to the true reconstruction using the analytical technique. So therefore, there's a new technique coming up, become more and more important. So the so-called iterative or statistical iterative reconstruction technique, this is something that we got involved for almost 20 years now. And we're going to tell you a little bit about that, because you cannot really solve that exact solution. People are still trying, but so far, nobody be able to solve the problem if you have the physics in the problem and not purely ideal situation. So now if you do the image reconstruction problem, if you take this like this case, planar you can see it, oblique you can see a little bit if you're lucky, if you know which projection to see. If you get all the projection, if you go through the image reconstruction, allow you to get now planar, two-dimensional planar. Now you can see at this section, you can see that it's involved in the spine. And you can even know what part of the spine, the spinal process is involved instead of the spinal body. So the two, three, now if you have many, many of this, you get a stack of the 2D image. So you can get a three-dimensional image reconstruction, and that's what's so exciting. Now you can see very clearly inside in the three-dimensional distribution of the distribution. Of course, in nuclear medicine, we look at radioactivity distribution. In X-ray CT, we look at the anatomical attenuation distribution, kind of very similar mathematics, but the physics are quite different. So this is so the single photon computed tomography started in Dr. Budinger. Dr. Budinger is the one that predicted in late 1977 there may be 6 more PhD thesis in reconstruction that will be done in the late 70s. So right now we're still more and more PhD dissertation. It's still going on. So he was wrong. So this is the kind of this time already the laboratory systems and G is coming out in 1981, the first system. And now they're all kind of modern system now. I think the system right now, around the world spec system, is probably around 15,000 or to 20,000 units around the world. Compared to PET, is probably around only 2,000, and is going up really fast. So PET spec is still a very much of a clinical system, more widely used compared to spec, although spec is still moving up. So these are some example of the spec images. One of the big application is in myocardial perfusion spec. And as you know, particularly for coronary artery diseases, And so almost if you, if knock on wood, if you have a problem or if cardiac perfusion problem, the chances that you will go through this procedure, 80%, I was told 80-90% of the patient will go through this particular procedure. Some of them will go to ultrasound and so on, as you heard this morning. And MRI, I understand, is still coming, that kind of routine clinical study. So bone study is also a very much of work, clinical work. Now, positron emission tomography, as I mentioned before, is that you you require the positron emitter. Those are the typical one, 418 becoming the dominant one, although carbon 11, oxygen 15, and nitrogen 13 has a lot of potential. The problem is the half-life. But F18, because of its kind of longer half-life and also becoming a you can get into label the deoxyglucose, become a super glucose analog, is a wonderful agent, like a magic bullet for cancer. So becoming becoming a very, very exciting technique for cancer. So the idea is the positron for the radionuclide emit the positron, and they emit its counterpart, the electron, and then they will disappear, just as I said earlier, and then the energy will convert into, you know, physics. It will convert to 2 5 11 keV that kind of emit in the 180 degree, about 180 degree. We'll come back to that point. So if you had built two detectors in coincident, and you can if you simultaneously detect the two photons, then you can detect the so-called the projection rate. You don't need to have the collimator in a single photon to allow you to get much higher sensitivity compared to a single photon. So this is the thing. But the problem is that in order to do the detector coincident, you require a very sophisticated detection circuitry. And give you an example for a GE Advanced, one of the most advanced systems, will sell you for will set you back for a couple million dollars, depending on how much discount you get. So this kind of with the many thousands, of hundreds and thousands of small tiny crystals that come into arranging blocks and then into a ring and so forth, and then they involve hundreds of thousands of those so-called coincident pair. And one of those highest resolution detector called the HRLT, you can will have 4.5 billion of those coincident lines for you to reconstruct. So you can see that those kind of positron. So the reason why it costs so much is because they have very complicated detector, hundreds and thousands of them, and then they have hundreds of thousands of millions of coincident lines. So that will let you sort them out. For pure mathematician, that's kind of boring. But if you do apply math, it's a wonderful project to do. It's very tedious, but it's very very difficult, but it's very, very interesting and very hard problem. So what are the advances in PET imaging? In PET imaging, so there's still a lot of advances in detector material still going on right now, and advances in the detector module and depth of interaction, so allow you to improve the resolution, and 3D acquisition, and three-dimensional image reconstruction technique. So the Nobel Prize winning technique is two-dimensional. Now we're going to three-dimensional reconstruction technique, and also we'll tell you a little bit about the four-dimensional image reconstruction technique. But some people talk about five-dimensional image reconstruction technique now. So those are the kind of things we are continuously moving forward. And also time of flight, PET is kind of a revival of time of flight. There are a lot of people working on that again. And also the micro-PET technique. So this is a slide borrowed from CPI showing the improvement in spatial resolution from 1975 to 1995. You can see that the technology has improved. The detector crystal and the size of the detector and the material, and those are major reason why spec, PET image quality have improved over the years. Very, of course, the cost of that, they predict the number of detectors, just like the speed of a computer, what is it, double every 18 months? So I think the number of detector in PET is double every 2 years. It's called the, there's a So that's the kind of people kind of talk about them. So it's a very fast increasing technology. And you can also see that the kind of images you can see, just give you some sample of them. A lot of them are now involving cancer now, you know, to get most of the business. And then brain is still a very, is a very loss of interest because the brain function is something that only PET allow you to see, like Alzheimer's and some of the diseases, or Parkinson's. You can look at receptor aging. In some way, in that sense, PET is more sensitive than MRI in terms of, because if one photon comes up, you can see it. Okay, and Leon can tell you, you need a lot of hydrogen in order to get a signal. So in that sense, PET is actually a very sensitive molecular imaging. If you can attach to one molecule, theoretically, you can see it. And so you can see that all kind of PET functional information allow you to see functional information, Huntington disease, and also look at the cancer, almost every cancer, not quite like the prostate and melanoma, I think it's not so good with FDG. Other than that, almost every tumor can be seen by the 418 FDG. So what are the advances in mission computer tomography? Again, I kind of repeated that again, it's a system instrumentation, reconstruction technique, and animal imaging. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we do in terms of improving the image quality. It leads you to maybe a little bit of why are we still working on this kind of thing in image reconstruction? And I told you that, you know, it sounds like it's already done. Somebody won a Nobel Prize, but I said there is still Nobel Prize to be won. What happened? What happened is that when you look at the image reconstruction technique, you're assuming everything is perfect. Unfortunately, the world is not perfect. Okay, and that's where physics comes in. A mathematician thinks that the world is wonderful. Everything is ideal. But in the real world, they're not. Okay, and then you make the math, it's very, very difficult. And this is a problem that the mathematicians still haven't solved yet. And people like ourselves, we're not so smart, as smart as you are. So we use a kind of different way to solve this problem, to tackle this problem, since then we solve this problem. So what are the image degradation factors? That means there are factors in real life that affect the data that you acquire. When the data get affected, that means that it's no longer ideal. So when you put into your image reconstruction technique, what my comic tell you, then when you get the image reconstructed, you won't get the truth. Now, again, the key about what I showed earlier, the key in medical imaging is to get the truth, okay? In image processing, you said, if you are a good image processor, what that means is that if you want the tumor to be big, no problem. You want to be small, no problem. You want the red, okay, blue, fine. And you want to disappear, good, okay? You want to make some tumor, I can do it, okay? So that's no problem for a perfect, great image processor. But for medical imaging, we don't do that, okay? And being pretty is not good enough. What we need to know is the truth. Nothing but the truth. Very simple. If the tumor is big, it's big. Small, it's small. Blue is blue, okay? There's no other way, okay? If it's ugly, it's ugly, okay? And you cannot make it different. So the key is to find the truth, okay? That's very important for all of us to know. We're not in Hollywood, okay? You guys can deal with Hollywood, but in the hospital, we're not in Hollywood. So we need to understand what the data you see is contaminated. I think that's, in order for you to find the truth, the first thing you need to know is that how does the data get contaminated? Okay, so when I come out, when I was a young graduate, I look at the field, I said, look, well, everybody are doing approximation. That's not what I want to do. So we went back to the lab and studied for 10 years of physics and understanding what's going on. Why does the image so bad in nuclear medicine? So what happened is that there are instrumentation factors that affect the image quality. The instrumentation, the collimator, the detector, they're all contaminated, but they change your resolution. Then the physical factors, like the photon attenuation, scattering, and beam hardening X-ray, and the scattering is a very messy problem in all kind of medical imaging techniques, X-ray, CT, nuclear medicine, all of that problem. And the patient anatomy, they are male, they're female, they have a flat diaphragm, quick bones, small bones. So is it the breast shadow? Is this all kind of problem that also affect your required data? And also motion. This is something that I call it four-dimensional image reconstruction. This is right now is a very hot topic. If you're interested in doing image reconstruction or mathematics, this is the kind of thing everybody's jumping into now. So what do we do? I'm not going to tell you the 15 years of work. Basically, what I'm going to tell you is that you take the projection data. If you take the projection data you acquire from day-to-day life with all those image degradation effect, okay? So if you take the analytical method, so-called Nobel Prize winning technique, okay? If you reconstruct the image, that's what you get, okay? This is the heart, this is the kidney, and this is the prostate. And you can tell me, this is what the conventional nuclear medicine is horrible. But that's why some people tease nuclear medicine is unclear medicine. So when I, like your age, when I walk in the field, I said, that's fine. If everything is beautiful, nothing for me to work on. So what do? So we basically, as I said, we try to solve the problem. And some of us still trying, and basically can't. It's a very difficult problem, so far, okay? We're still waiting for you, some of the young guys, to come up. So we can't. So we find a dumb method, very dumb mathematical method. We say, okay, we use so-called the iterative reconstruction, a little bit more sophisticated than that. Some now is so-called the statistical iterative reconstruction method. They incorporate noise statistic into the algorithm. So as you know, the iterative algorithm is more than just iterating, okay? Some of you know that is just simplified things. The key about what we do in a so-called quantitative is to get back to the truth, is to put the physics into that inside the iterative reconstruction. I mean, when we do the projection and the back projection, when we calculate the projection data to compare with our measured data, which the only thing we have, is that we put that physics back in so that now we can hopefully, we can get closer to the measured data. And that's a very simple truth, very simple. That's what we do. Why do we do that? Why don't we go to the standard image processing technique your professors teach you? Okay? The problem is that most of the image processing techniques are linear process, some of you know. Okay? Unfortunately, a lot of the imaging process is non-linear, okay? And it's not stationary. So therefore, basically, a lot of the image processing technique, you can pretty much go down the drain, okay? But you can use it for approximation. But if you really, really want to solve the problem, you can. As I said, I think most of you are still working, you know, your PhD dissertation is non-linear problem, and that's what we have, so we can solve it. So what we do is using the iterative reconstruction, we put a very good modeling, that's where the physics come in. And then when you do that, you can get back to a much better quality compared to this. And using the same set of data, you basically try to understand the physics. And that is the kind of thing that we have done over the last 15 years. The company tell me to go away, tell most of us to go away. But now they're all kind of embracing it now. Before, it would take a lot of time, it's just impractical. Now his computers speed is going up twice every 18 months. So all the things used to take days, now take minutes now. Okay, so now it's possible to do it now, and so everybody's embracing it. Because of that, and because of part of the reason we want to do this quantitative is attenuation correction. So in the early days, companies going to design all kind of way to measure the transmission so they get the attenuation map. To solve this, to get to the quantitative technique. So all this actually is all going away now. This is all kind of go up in 10 years, now all go away. The major thing now coming up is the only thing that left behind is the transmission using the CT. It's originally to use that to measure the attenuation coefficient so that allow you to get a better reconstruction for quantitation, as I said. But later on, In the second generation machine now, people don't use a low power X-ray CT anymore. It's using a so-called diagnostic quality X-ray CT. Now you have SPECT machine, tied to a big CT scanner. So now instead of using it just for attenuation correction, now you can also use it for multimodality imaging. So this is kind of a trend going out, and also like PET CT now becoming, you can do both now. You can do registration, you can look at anatomy and these function at the same time. You can also do attenuation correction. So in PET CT, Dave Townsend started that. When he started thinking about that, he asked a physician, do you think PET CT will be useful? And the physician said, I don't think so. So he went ahead anyway. So as a physicist, sometimes you just kind of go ahead and do it, okay? And then when you get it done, okay, and then all the physicians said, wow, we've got to use this. No way we can do PET without a CT now. So you can see that sometimes you have to have something that people find a use for it. But this is a very good example of happening. So now every manufacturer, all within 5 years, okay, every manufacturer is now selling only PET CT. Okay, no more PET anymore. Okay, so things are changing really, really very fast. So this kind of machine that costs you, let's say every company coming out with a beautiful PET CT, CT, and PET, both are very high resolution diagnostic quality. You can allow to do attenuation correction and to do a kind of diagnostic purpose. And even the latest one, the Philips, even come out with a machine that you can separate, you can even do intervention while you're scanning. So this is kind of, even now, imaging machine used to be in radiology, in diagnostic radiology. And more you find now, and imaging machine is now in therapy. In radiation oncology, they buy, they do x-ray, they do imaging all the time. And surgery, okay, if you go to Harvard, if I understand, they're building a surgery suite with what? With 4 Tesla, MR, with PET CT, you know, with all in one suite. Okay, you know, all the x-ray ultrasound, everything. So those imaging is going, not, it's not staying just in diagnostic radiology. It's going to radiation oncology big time. Also already, and also in surgery, in cardiology, in everything. Very exciting. And now when you put all the physics in, you can see some of this and the work we do in the medium and high energy collimator. One of the problems with high energy inspect collimator is imaging is that those high energy can penetrate the so-called receptor, will give you a very bad point response function. So when you do it, say this is an experiment, this is real data. You do experiment with 3 sphere, and then if you do a reconstruction because of all this detector response, you can see all kind of artifacts. If you do the filter back rejection, so-called Nobel Prize technique, it's no good, okay? When you use this iterative technique, so-called OSEM, order subset, and expectation maximization, we all know the mathematics, and you can put the physics in, you can really clean up things beautifully in terms of noise, resolution, and that's what your professor tells you never happened, right? Your professor tells you using linear filtering. You can either get resolution, you sacrifice noise, or you get noise. You don't have any resolution. You load the noise and no resolution. But now with this type of technique, putting your physics into the mathematical algorithm, you can simultaneously, okay, improve the quality in terms of getting better resolution and noise. This is not something you can do with a conventional processing technique. And this is to give you an idea about the clinical application in cardiac. And it's a perfusion study. Is I guess it's perfusion is where see whether the heart is functional properly. If you have a clot, a coronary artery, you will have a defect. The perfusion will show a defect. But this will show you the conventional technique compared to putting all the different physics, attenuation only, and scatter compensation only. Now that putting an attenuation scatter and detector response, and you can see the progressive improvement in terms of both resolution and noise. And this is how you combine the mathematics and the physics into your image reconstruction. Okay, so far I can kind of give you a kind of a broad, very quick idea. Now, I said before, in what we do, it's not just to make the image pretty. Every morning you look at the mirror, you look at yourself, I'm the most beautiful and handsome person in the world. Correct? Right? If you don't compare to anybody, you look at yourself, you're beautiful. But you can do that, okay? You have to compare in medical imaging. You have to compare to whatever is available and also compare to the truth. So how do you compare? So this is a very important thing for us, is medical image assessment. How do you assess? When you get yourself image processing technique done, your reconstruction done, how do you know this is good? You get a new technique done, how do you know it's better than the other one? How do you know you get the truth? So the key is that, so you have to do some kind of image assessment. So beauty contacts, it's not good enough. Okay, you just say, this is pretty, I'm done. My dissertation is done. That's not done, you just begin, okay, to us. So the goal is to seek the truth, okay? So the true status of the patient, that's what we need, instrumentation, image technique. The problem is that if you do patient, you don't know what the truth is. You don't find the truth. You don't know what the truth is. So it becomes a catch-22. Okay, in an example, like recently, NIH did a big study, a lung nodule study, right, to collect all the clinical data. They say, okay, we need to study, get a database. This morning, somebody asked, we got a database. So you got a huge database, and I spent tens of million dollars. So the question is, okay, so you want to evaluate some image processing technique. How do you evaluate? You don't know the truth. You know which one is better. So what do? So they get a panel of 6-7 experts. It's consensus. You know what? 6 or 7 experts, 7 or 6 opinions. So they got a problem. Okay? So what do you do? Okay, so we're offering a technique, it's called simulation. Because in computer simulation, we know the truth. Okay, so this is the premise. The problem is, a lot of people like simulation. It's a common criticism, is computer simulation is a computer game. Okay, it's useless, it's a waste of time, too much simulation may seem like the real thing, simulation remain simulation. Okay, so why? Because the previous limitation is that we have very simple phantom, is not realistic, and also the projection data, the data is not simulated like a real data. So also take a long time to do. So what can we do? Okay, so we started the journey many years ago. This is starting 10, 15 years ago. It's not just like yesterday. Okay, take a long time for us to do this kind of thing. So what we do is 3 things. Again, attack the problem. We improve the computer-generated phantom to make it more and more like a human. Okay. Second is that we improve the data generation technique, make it more and more like the instrument. Okay. And also, you go very high-speed computer. Okay. So what's the phantom? So in the day, if you look at the journal article in 20 years ago, that's what they do. And the physician look at that, you guys are crazy. They don't even take a look at it anymore. Okay. So and then we look at this mathematical phantom. So the problem is very simple, it's flexible, but it's not realistic. The other end is that you take a patient data and then you segment it, okay? And then you say, okay, it's very complex now. That's what we do. We take that TD data segment, okay? The super phantom, you take it. The problem is it's inflexible. It's realistic, but it's inflexible. You can change it, okay? So what do? There's something in between. You can do mathematical phantom, but it's kind of not really there. So we took a look 15 years ago. We took the look at the standard man phantom. It's basically every organ is described by mathematical equations. Okay, so that was the phantom being used in dosimetry calculation many years ago. We started with that, but the weight is accurate, the shape is ugly. This is called the heart. You can tell it's terrible. So we spent 5-6 years and asked the graduate student, the engineering student, they're not mathematics student. So every student come in, you want to do a PhD? Spend a year with me and change the math, change the equation to make it more and more realistic. Okay, so we start changing the equation, make the equation describe the shape better. Okay, so you can go on and on, but so the best we can do, up until about, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, that's what we can do. Pretty good. We make the rib tilt and we make it moves and breathe and the heartbeats and everything. Okay, we actually talk to the cardiologist and talk to understanding all the physiology. We actually mathematically, everything is equations. Okay. But to the point with that, well, that's the best we can do. The PSA is still not good enough. So what do? So then we went to something called the visible human data set. Some of you know, it's a very thin CT and MR slice from a healthy, okay, male and female cadaver. Okay, you think about how do we get that. Some of you may know the answer. Okay, and then also thin anatomical image slice. So you get all the slice like a pork chop. Okay, it's very thin, 8 millimeter. Okay. And then you also have very fine, very thin CT images. So from that, you can, this is a healthy person, by the way, okay? So you can segment it, okay? And so what we use that time is use something called the nerve. We went to computer science, asked the professor, what do they use? They told us to use something called nerve. That's what they do in Pixar. That's what they do in computer graphic, in cartoons. So it's okay, we come back, we learn the stuff. So all of you know in this room, I imagine, that you can use something called basically it's a spline. It's a spline, two-dimensional spline. You can describe a surface. Okay, and then also the nice thing about this curve is that you can modify the surface using from the control points. Okay, and that's what the computer animation do. Okay, and that's we borrow that. Okay, we take that, we segment all the organs, and then we use, and then we get the control point and use that. Now we can start changing to fit what we need. I'll tell you why we do that. Okay, so what we do is that this is a nice dissertation work, right? If you want to get a really see how hard a student work. So we got Paul Seegers, okay? He become very well known because this phantom now has 300 sites once, you know, we have over 300 users now. And that time, he do one rip, would take a day to segment. This is about 10 years, well, maybe 8 years ago now. Of course, now today, it's very careful work, okay? And then we can take all the segment, all the organ, and put it very carefully together from those CT data, okay? And then that's the extension. We had recently, the last five years or so, we extended to the whole body, and including a prostate area, because we have the gland to do prostate, we have the blood vessels, and the lymph nodes, and everything you can think about, you need in imaging. We even, you know, get the trachea tree, the entire trachea tree, we have the bone, the blood vessel, the brain, and everything. Okay? So we're still improving. Now, why do we want to do NERD? Because of we want to get an anatomical variation. Because one of the goals we want to do is to do clinical trial inside the computer. If you want to do a clinical trial, you cannot use one phantom. You have to do a population with people with different size, you know, female, male, and so on. So we, with this NERD-based phantom, allow us to create genders, body size, and body shape. We can create a population of patients in our computer now. And we also uptake distribution, and also we can put in myocardial defect. We know that. We know exactly what we have in study. We know the truth. Okay? So that's the key. Now, because of this, we have a lot of other people not in imaging kind of interested. This is symmetry people. We have DOD wanting people want to shoot the patient shotgun and see the body explode. So now because of we basically merge very good biology. You have to know biology. We study every cardiologist. We ask questions, cardiologists can't even answer us. And then also computer graphics. We put them together. So we have this kind of phantom. So we have even have a from different size, different age kind of phantom. Then the next question, how do we generate data? The phantom is not good enough. The phantom looks like a human. So we need to get data. The data is that we need to get a good model of what's happening in the photon transport in the body and also instrumentation. Okay? So you can do an analytical method. It's fast, but it's approximation. It's not very good. So we have gone into the Monte Carlo simulation. You can get very accurate, but it's very time consuming. As you can see, also there are many, many Monte Carlo packages available. If you really ask, tell me, I can tell you which one is good, which one. They all have advantage and disadvantage. We actually use all of them, okay? Depending on what we use, we kind of know which one is good in what sense. And then you also need the cluster. So we have started building a cluster in our group 7-8 years ago. So now we have a 130 processor cluster just to do Monte Carlo, humming all the time. That room, if you shut the air conditioner off, you go up 80 degrees and 90 degrees very fast, 10 minutes. It's just constantly running simulation. We can generate CT, we can generate projection data very accurately. This is from a handicap phantom, looks almost like a human. We can also generate the emission data, transmission data and emission data. It looks like a human. We can also simulate X-ray CT, the whole X-ray spectrum. We can simulate every energy bin. Then we can scale them according to the spectrum. We sum them up so we can simulate the whole energy spectrum for the CT. You can see the kind of simulated images. We're getting closer and closer. We actually, Paul just got a grant from NIH. We're going to extend this phantom to CT. We started this phantom from nuclear. Now we're extending the next 3 years. We're going to get a much higher resolution in detail for CT application. The other important thing is that we don't play computer games. Every simulation we do, we have to validate with experiment. Okay, this is something very important. So we validate it in the Monte Carlo with experimental measurement, make sure that we're not just playing computer games. And then also, this is a validated X-ray earlier as a nuclear medicine, make sure both is validated. So once with a phantom, so what do we do with a phantom? Okay, this is one thing we can do, is that we can study the different effect. If you have attenuation, what happened to the image? If you don't have any effect, if your data are ideal, you can do filter back projection, you can get beautiful image, just like comics said. The way our bias reading works, okay? But if your data have attenuation effect, you don't get the exact data, the true data. If you get a detector response, get blurry, you get scattered, even low contrast, you get noise, very ugly. Now you can study the effect. You can also study, we mentioned to you, we study iterative reconstruction. You can also use the phantom to study the different iterative reconstruction method as a function of this mean, this bias, and also the noise. So if you know the truth, you can study that. You can also study, we publish this kind of thing to study the noise, the variance image, or filter pack projection of the iterative reconstruction. Why does iterative reconstruction look better? And this is something we study, because the variance is proportional, almost proportional to the mean. We can also model, you know, coronary artery, we model plaque, and then we can see which part of the cardiac had defect. And then we can study now with the phantom, we can study, okay, without attenuation correction, all kind of artifact you created, you know, with no defect and with anterior defect, with certain defect. This is the truth. And then if you don't do correction, depending on the anatomy, you can see all kind of artifact. But if you correct for it, you know the truth, you know, you come back to the truth, and you know the technique works. Okay, that's the key. If you don't know, you cannot evaluate. Now we know, we can evaluate. And this is also trying to evaluate using the bullseye, as Dr. Exo talked about the bullseye to study the heart. You can also look at the heart as the different improvement method. Does it work? Okay, and then because we know the truth, we can compare. If you don't know the truth, nothing you can, you know. This also with a simulated image, we show you how the improvement is. The different function, also a function of iteration, allow you to study your technique in great detail. And then we also take, as Dr. Neon Exo said, we take the TAG MR data many years ago, and we took the TAG MR data, and we created from this TAG data, we created, look at the velocity vector, we actually created a beating heart model. Actually, you don't see that, is that we can divide into five layers. This model actually has a twisting model also, okay? It's not just beating model. And if you can look at that, you can actually, from the MR tag data, you can also look at the twisting motion of the heart. You know, you can see that it reverse the direction. So from the tag MR data, we build it in the model that have both beating, the contraction and beating motion. So this is really realistic. One of the things, why do we want to do that? One of the things we want to do in the study of the NIH grant is to study four-dimensional image reconstruction technique. As you know that Dr. Exer said, is that in nuclear medicine, we look at perfusion, okay? But we also want to look at cardiac motion. But the problem is that we don't have any resolution. And also we have terrible counts. So what do? So we start looking at some four-dimensional image reconstruction method, okay? So how do you compare to three-dimensional method and also filter back detection. Again, so we use our phantom, and we divide the phantom in 144 frames, and then we bin them into 8 frames, 16 frames, 24 frames, and 36 frames, and then assuming simulating equal acquisition time. So what you find is that didn't show up. I didn't show up, I don't know why. Okay. And you can compare now with the same set of data. You can see that if you go to 36 frames, each frame is very noisy, okay, because you have the equal time. Okay, but you have better beating motion. This computer is not fast enough. This computer is not fast enough. But if you use the conventional method, if you go to more frames, you're noisier. But using a four-dimensional method, you can see, okay, you can retain the resolution, but also with all the correction, detector response attenuation, you can get the resolution and the noise down. Okay, you can also you can get it into a 36 frame. This is the kind of thing that we're doing right now. Okay, I'm sorry, I can't move, do the movie because of the computer, too slow. Anyway, faster computer. See that, but I think we can look at it later. But now it's trying to work. But you can see that when you go down, it's that you have more frame. You can see better motion, but the noise goes bad if you use the conventional method and so forth. So then you also we go and take the lung data. We got the lung data from University of Iowa from Eric Hoffman, as some of you know. As a great physiologist using imaging to study physiology, it's gated lung data that we can allow us to build. Again, we look at the gated CT of lung. We take 286 bifurcation point in the lung, and that's a function of the different gate. From that, we build up a breathing motion at different gates. Okay, again, you know, look at the bifurcation point, 286, and then we interpolate, so we have all the vector view, three-dimensional vector view in the lung. Okay. And why do you want to do that? Because we find out that all the effect is that respiratory motion also affect your cardiac perfusion study. Okay. From the respiratory motion, we find out you can change, you can create kind of artifact in your study. Okay. So we can use that to study how do we put gates and so on. So what else are we going to do? So in the future, we're working on a few things, we're working on more detail to push to high resolution imaging. We're building a coronary artery tree. We're also working on a multi-scale modeling, something you mentioned. We heard that this morning. So in the coronary artery, we start with a low generation using X-ray CT, the new four-dimensional X-ray CT. You can get about two or three generations and you don't have any resolution. So what do? So we want to build a tree. So we went to the literature. We find a model of the coronary artery, okay, tree based on the PIC model. And then we build that. Okay, using that model and build the rest of the tree. So now we can have a whole tree now and up to the order 11th order. Okay, and this is a paper we're going to present next week and show you how we can extend the coronary artery and also make it beat. Now we can beat with the heart, with the coronary artery. Okay, and then we're also working with people, Elliot Fishman at Radiology, UNC, the CT, one of the big CT. Radiologists and also Ray Winslow of BMU in Hopkins, and taking the diffusion tensor MRI, you know, and information to build a mechanical model of that, and combining with finite element analysis, working with Lawrence Berkeley Lab and also University of Utah, and building a mechanical model based on the cell level to the fiber level to the sheet level and all the way to the anatomical level. Okay, I think I better stop here because I think I should skip the small animal imaging part because of the time reason. So I should just entertain some, because only 1 hour, maybe some questions you want.